The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and Children of the Setting Sun's Daryl Hilaire. I'm Stephanie Contouris. We have a lot to talk about this week, a lot from the last time we talked. The Picket Bridge no longer has a sign since our last get-together, and a couple of other things. We've got Rosalinda Guillen talking about what's happening in Tacoma, Sat Paul Sidhu. We'll be talking about what is happening on Labor Day. And of course, we will be talking about the state of emergency with salmon in our waters. But first, just a couple of quick updates. Bellingham Racial Justice Coalition and Imagine No Cages are reporting that Judge Snyder has granted a warrant to Whatcom County Sheriff's Office to search the Bellingham No Dapples Coalition Facebook page. Imagine No Cages argues that the decision scoffs in the face of the First and Fourth Amendments, and we will get to that hopefully later in the show. And we have some other things to report, some grants coming into Bellingham, but right now we're going to talk about a new hunger strike at the Tacoma Detention Center, and Rosalinda is here to tell us what happened today.
A large group of allies and supporters from community to community development supporting Maru Mora Villalpando during a stressful time. She received a call from the Northwest Detention Center that a group of Cuban detainees had gone on a hunger strike. I believe this is going to be the fifth one this year. So what's happening right now with this hunger strike is that a group of Cuban detainees in that prison have decided to go on strike because Homeland Security has told them that there is no process for them, that the Trump administration and Homeland Security has no idea what they're going to do with undocumented Cuban people, even though some of those Cuban detainees are questioning why they're even detained. Needless to say, they have been going through some very difficult times inside the detention center in Tacoma. And a couple of nights ago, they decided to start a hunger strike to try to get some attention to their cause about what's going on. Again, it's the same type of issues. The food is horrific, not enough food to eat. The treatment from the guards, the treatment from the management, from the GEO Corporation has been bad. So our sister, Maru Mora Villalpando, who leads the Northwest Detention Resistance, is there trying to bring some relief to those detainees because they have this, when they went on strike, they were what they call thrown into the hole. So they're in solitary confinement, being treated very badly. And the last time that farm workers or detainees went on strike inside the detention center, they were force-fed very violently. And then eventually they were removed from the detention center. And I have to let all of our people listening that what is happening now with detention and immigration, these kinds of immigration prisons, is that for all intents and purposes, these folks that were on a hunger strike a couple of weeks ago have disappeared. They have been disappeared. They have been shipped to other immigration prisons without anybody's knowledge of where they went, without any way for their families and loved ones and activists like Maru Mora Villalpando to locate them. And this is becoming a more and more frequent behavior from Homeland Security, which, and these private prison corporations, where we're calling this basically treating immigrant workers like prisoners of war.
The last time that we reported on the hunger strikes at the Tacoma Detention Center, we didn't hear a lot about how those ended. And what you're saying is the same people who went on hunger strike before, you are no longer able to contact, and
that's,
you don't
right.
know where they are.
They disappeared almost from, you know, in the evening. The next morning they were gone. And I believe that Maru Mora Villalpando managed to locate two of them in a immigration prison in Arizona. And our sister organization, Puente, has been trying in vain to contact them inside, to bring them some kind of legal representation. But it is becoming more and more difficult. And I think that that is our concern. As an organization, community to community is in solidarity and trying to use all of our resources and knowledge to protect, again, to save lives from inside the immigration detention center and bring at least the dignity that these workers deserve by calling attention and letting everybody know what's going on. So they're at the detention center as we speak. There's a group of C2C supporters and activists joining Maru Mora Villalpando as she tries desperately to call attention to what Homeland Security is doing in conjunction with and in partnership with these global prison corporations that are actually not just mistreating our people and denying them their human rights, but they're making money off
of it.
They're
doing it for profit.
They are profiting incredibly.
Right. Chio, last time, I haven't reached out to them, but last time they said that people were basically bored, that they could buy apples from the commissary. And so I have to ask, because people outside see you as somebody who's not in the detention center, how do you know that the information that you have is verifiable?
Because the people inside tell us. What kind of verification do you want other than people constantly getting sick because they're not eating enough, the depression levels, the numbers of people in depression go high. And when the family members go in and talk to their loved ones and see them losing weight, looking unhealthy, and they're being told they're not getting enough to eat, and the family members can't even take them any food. They can't eat anything that is not purchased at the commissary. And I've heard stories that even like a packet of salt costs $4 if they get to work, which is almost like a special treat to be allowed to work, you know. But then it's like a few cents per hour. It's a humiliation process. It's a process for losing their humanity and their dignity, but it's also very unhealthy. In community to community, we say this over and over again. We are on the side of workers. And if workers tell us these things are happening, we believe them.
You have just stated how dangerous it is to go on a hunger strike. If Cuban people have knowledge of this and they choose to go on a hunger strike anyway,
it's an expression of how bad the conditions are. Because everybody in the detention center knows about the hunger strikes. There's 1,650 people inside that prison. And they all know what's going on. So they're not going on a hunger strike for attention or for pleasure. This is a last desperate effort for not even for release or anything other than see me, hear me, I am dying in here. It's a last call for dignity to say, I at least am trying during my last moments to do something that brings me back my human dignity. And the saddest part about it is that, you know, when you look at the Tacoma prison, it's right next door to the Tacoma Dome. And people are going to concerts and all this. And this is where this country is at, is that right in plain sight, we are torturing, mistreating human beings. We've created this other that deserves to be treated this way. And so, you know, I mean, we're, as an organization, we're at the front lines of trying to call attention to this, of people that are in prison because they're undocumented. But at the same time, we've also been out here, not inside a prison, in Northeast Whatcom County in Sumas, again, undocumented immigrant workers living in a prison camp with a worker that died because he was malnourished and extreme dehydration.
And I remember reporting that 60 people or more, so it was 100 people, went on a one-day protest and lost their jobs.
That's
but
right.
Had not been given visas by Sarbanant. And so there was a camp set up for them. And what is the status right now?
So those workers were fired and asked to leave. And when you are fired, then you are no longer under the protection of the visa program that brought you there. You're no longer under protection of anything, and they were asked to leave the property of the company with no money, no nothing, no transportation. You don't speak the language. So this encampment was set up in rural Sumas, and there were over 120 workers in that encampment. And I just, while I have a minute, to thank our community for their response. It was quick. It was abundant. It was done in such a selfless manner. I have been enriched and absolutely not surprised, but overwhelmed with how the community responded, both the over the majority white community, but also the Latino community. I think everybody understands that a worker dying because he's underfed, malnourished, and also dehydration in our own community is just something that should not be happening. So we put up a strong fight. We sustained them while they were there. We took their stories. We had tons of media. It was overwhelming. So we did manage to get them their flights to go back to Mexico, but there's still a lot of work to be done. There is a lawsuit being prepared. The Department of Labor and Industries, Department of Health, and Washington and Employment Security Department are conducting interviews and investigations. So I urge everybody to call them and say, you have better hold this company accountable for what happened.
And I just want to wrap up by emphasizing that people may see community as being immigrant rights or immigrant issues, but your scope is much more interconnected.
It's much more interconnected because we are farm workers. We are human beings like everybody else, and we care about all of the issues that are affecting everybody in our community. But as farm workers, we also understand that Mother Earth feeds us. We work on the land to feed all of you that eat food. And the fact that one decision can say that we are an illegal human being does not take away from us the fact that we also care about Mother Earth. We care about you. We care about the eaters. And that we're members of this community.
Rosalinda, thank you so much. I know you're dealing with a lot of fronts right now. Thank you for taking the time to give us an update.
Thanks for the time to talk.
Rosalind again from Community to Community Development, talking about Cuban detainees, hunger strike at the Tacoma Detention Center, and the Sarbanon Farms workers. A longer interview will be up on CascadiaNewsNow.com. Rosalinda also talked about what is happening with the state of emergency of salmon and how it relates to issues that she's concerned with. I urge you to go to CascadiaNewsNow.com and listen to the entire interview. This is Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and we're welcoming Daryl Hilaire. Daryl, thank you for being here.
Hello. Happy to be here.
We are honored, and we unfortunately are talking about not one of the happiest issues. As people have probably heard, the weekend of the 19th, a net pen failed, and I think I have heard different numbers about how many salmon they estimate have been released. As of today, it's now an international incident. The Seattle Times reports that the Atlantic salmon that were released last week are now entering Canadian waters. And Daryl, you were at some of the sites today. Do you want to just give us some background and an update?
Yes, I went out to Cypress Island this morning. The Lummi Law and Order patrol boat brought Candy Wilson and Jewel James and members of the Seattle Times reporting staff, as well as resources to go out there. We were asked to see what was happening there and perhaps stand with the fishermen and what they might want to do today for bringing this issue to a stage of, well, what are we going to do? And What are we thinking and feeling right now? We didn't get to gather everybody together. That wasn't what happened. We thought we might do that under the chairman's direction. But, you know, there are so many things going on at Lummi that that didn't happen. So we checked in with Jay Julius, council member, and seeing what was going on. They have a crane out there. They're dismantling the pen. You know, this is Cook Incorporated. And then there aren't as many fishermen out there as there were last week because you know, the amount of fish they're able to capture has gone down. But there's still quite a few. Jay's out there with Steve Solomon, and Dana Wilson's out there, and Vernon Lane, a number of others. They're going to continue. They're trying to decide when to leave. They want to do a good job. When you think about stewardship, you think about stewardship in terms of, well, they're good stewards because they say that and they write policies and, you know, they support, you know, the habitat and all that. But stewardship is also in the event of disaster, in the event of whether that's a natural disaster or this, which is entirely human-made, how are you going to respond? Well, our fishermen and our leadership responded in such a way, well, let's remove the harm. And they got to work right away. And as soon as they mobilized, they were there and they recovered over 20,000 salmon so far.
Well, Daryl, it's great to have you on the show. It would be nicer to have you on here under better circumstances. But let me ask a stupid question. What is the harm? There's more fish in Puget Sound. So what?
Well, you know, the importance of wild salmon isn't just the importance of a salmon that we're going to commodify today. No, salmon's our relative. Salmon's our most respected ancestor. Salmon comes from the headwaters of the rivers, and they're born into this life in the most purest form. And it's a gift from the Creator that we as the Lummi people, the Saish people, can be part of that life cycle. You know, every year they're born, dissolved, and recreated. And that's a gift from the Creator. And then when you artificially create something in that name, it's an insult. You know, it's insulting to think that people can come in and industrialize, which is something that's very sacred to our people. So, it's like, so what if we raise chickens in a chicken coop and they never leave there and they eat their feces and, you know, and the people don't know it, so we're going to give it to them anyway because it's not healthy, but so what?
Right.
Cows too.
Right. Well, my understanding is that these fish actually are, I'll use the word existential, an existential threat to wild fish because they're voracious feeders of young fish, and their biology can short circuit and interrupt the biology of wild fish in their hatcheries and fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right, because it may seem like, oh, salmon is salmon and salmon, but there's a huge difference between the Atlantic salmon and the Pacific salmon that belong in these waters. And Dave, I know you were saying something the other day about the size or the growth.
Yeah, and these are, you know, one of the reasons these fish are farmed the way they are is because they grow very quickly and they eat voraciously. And, you know, there have been some folk from the state saying, well, these fish are used to being fed, so they're not likely that many of them will survive. But a lot of that has yet to be seen. And, you know, like you were saying, Daryl, these are, you know, drugged up, dyed pink, non-native fish, and I don't believe that we need them here in Puget Sound, but if we're going to have them, it's really disappointing that we didn't have a better disaster plan from the state level in the first place.
Has this ever happened before? Have there been with commercial big fish farms in Washington State this kind of threat?
Yes, there have been, and you know, the interesting question in my mind is, you know, what does it take before this gets reexamined? I mean, what sort of catastrophe does it actually take before we begin to realize what, you know, Lummi, Swinomish, all the tribes have been saying for years is a terrible, terrible idea, should not be in our waters, and that's an interesting question, what it takes.
We're still reacting to what's being said. You know, initially, you know, they were saying just go out and fish, you free fish. So there really wasn't any presence of guilt or disaster in their minds. It was like, you know, there's no big deal. And now, of course, that's elevating now, you know. And we still don't trust what's being put out in the media, because originally, and I was there when Larry Kinley and Ellie Kinley, they called me when they first happened, because their sons caught the first Atlantic salmon by lummy fishermen when they were out at Point Williams. And they said, this is odd. What are these fish? And they called their parents, and they said, oh, that's Atlantic salmon. Where are you at, you know? And then I got on the horn to Linda Mapes, and she started checking with DFW, and they were saying, oh, yeah, we checked with them. And they said they had a small spill of 300 salmon. And so from then, so it's just been changing and changing, and now they're putting stuff out in the media that they're just harmless. You know?
Well, and one of the things that I thought was so frustrating, is so frustrating about this story, is that when it first broke, we heard this from the Cook Aquaculture that it was because of the equinox tides, and it was almost presented as this amusing little story. Oh, well, the tides were high, and then it rolled out, and it's, I've heard, what, something like 300,000 maybe now?
Could be as many as that. And again, you know, we rely on, the company does its self-reporting, and so we rely on the company to say that something that they're ultimately liable for, to give us good reporting on something that they're ultimately liable for. You know, that's a big stretch. I mean, that's one of the problems with the system as it is these sorts of failures are self-reported. I mean, the only reason that we found out about it, I think, with the rapidity we did, was because of these really heroic fishermen who, you know, saw something wrong and got on the phone to the relatives and people at Lummi Nation and said, this is not good. Now, one question I have for you, Daryl, is, what would Lummi fishermen be doing right now if they weren't mopping up this huge mess?
They'd be out either fishing pinks or if the season's open, or fishing kings if the season's open. That's what they'd be doing, you know. And the thing that is not being said, I don't know how to really state this clear enough, but it seems like the burden of proof is on us. You know, and it's on these people that are supposed to be in charge, when really, in the very beginning, the burden of proof should be on Cook that these things will not happen, and that what we're growing is not genetically altered or, you know, promoted as salmon. We don't even know what kind of salmon they're selling. Is there any kind of standard that they're supposed to reach, you know, for them to be even doing this?
And this is not fish you want.
Right.
Well, I agree with that completely. I think that this is a compounded disaster because we cannot trust Cook in their statements now. They have lied too many times about what is happening here, and we need to get them out of the way and get people on the ground who can actually review what's happening. And ideally, that would be the state, but they are not moving as quickly as I would like. And, you know, on top of all of this, we have spent so much money and time rebuilding salmon habitat. You know, new culverts, removing blocks, restoring streams, you know, and this, to have something like this happen and to not have a dedicated response is really disappointing.
Right. And Daryl, I just want to ask you, because I know you and I talk, and I know you like talking about this, but I'd like to ask you about the response of Lummi tribal leadership. I know you were once a chairman. You have a chairman now, and I know you're proud as could be of the people currently on the council. Maybe you can talk about them and their response and how they met this head on.
They met it head on. You know, initially with a lot of anger, you know, and it was our leadership that gathered themselves together and immediately said that we're gonna clean this up. One, two, we're gonna put the governor on notice that there shouldn't be any permits moving forward. So they did that, and then three, you know, publicly stating not only our chairman but Chairman Cladisby at Swinomish, who's not just the chairman of Swinomish, but the president of the National Congress of American Indians, that, you know, these pens need to be removed, you know. And that's interesting that as this unfolds, like it might have been the same day or the day after, BC nations are doing the same thing, mm-hmm. you know, and now it's a matter of
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Us joining hands with them in this effort. There's Alert Bay, and I think Malahat, and I think tomorrow at Sarlup, which is in Victoria. They're having a protest tomorrow, but or a demonstration or, you know, war party tomorrow. But in Alert Bay, they the chief gave them an eviction notice. So they're going to be doing that up and down the BC coast.
I read that First Nations Canadian Bob Chamberlain, who's vice chairman of the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs, has complained specifically and made this an issue with Jay Inslee. You know, because it is our state. It is now an international incident. So I just want to recap. We're getting to the top of the hour, and I just want to recap. It's hundreds of thousands of salmon that are Atlantic salmon that are much larger, and they are drastically impacting Lummi Nation's ability to just live and fish as you normally would, as well as what might happen to the future of the fish that are native to this to our waters. What are the possible far-reaching environmental and dangers to the to our fish?
Well, it was reported to our government that the salmon have been caught in the Nooksack River, the Samish River, the Skagit River. They've been caught out at Lower Elawa, you know, near Port Angeles. So what do we know about that? Well, not much. You know, we're still trying to figure that out. We'll be relying on those people that we can see as experts on what they're doing, you know, whether they're eating fry or whether they're, you know, taking over, you know, or being detrimental to the current salmon stock. You know, we're just going to find those things out and take a position.
Well, this is, I guess the tragedy is, my understanding is this is a vital season for fishing, and it may very well be a lost season, because here you've spent 5 days or 10 days or however many days, you know, basically cleaning up fish that you don't want and not getting the fish that are vital to your way of life.
That's correct, and most importantly, as stewards, ensuring that we're the fulfilling those responsibilities, doing what needs to be done to protect our most sacred resource.
We are listening to Cascadia. You're listening to Cascadia News Now, when that's Daryl Hilaire, who we're very, very grateful took time amongst this emergency to be here and give us some insight to and the sort of share the seriousness and the extreme of this situation. You are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham and KAVZ 102.5 in Deming and Van Zandt. Oh, so we're talking about this issue, and I'm wondering, from what I've read, it sounds like the Lummi Nation's working with the Washington Department of Natural Resources, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Washington Department of Ecology, and yet it was the Lummi Nation that called the state of the emergency. Why was that?
Because we're fishermen. Because that's our lifeway. That's something that's taken seriously on the front end, and, you know, not in the back end, because if you think about things being done in the back end, and that's what happened within those state agencies, they had their meetings, and then they had their committee meetings, and they had the regulations to follow, or if there's no regulations, make them up, and by that time, it's, you know, a week later.
And the salmon have gone
right,
everywhere.
Right,
and so you were able to, the Lummi Nation was able to act and sort of get everybody else
right.
Marshaled up. So in a way, the entire state and the entire West Coast has to be grateful to the Lummi Nation for being able to and taking that stand and recognizing the seriousness right away.
Yeah, my my hat is off, and you know, I stand with the fishermen and the leadership that have been out there since last week. You know, all Jay wanted was a clean shirt. Yeah, and he's trying to decide when to come home.
Right. My understanding is that at the final state level, the authority there is DNR, which manages tidal lands for the state of Washington. And Hillary Franz, as our lands commissioner, has been a little more forceful than Jay in saying that no more permits for this will be allowed for aquaculture of this sort until there's a more thorough investigation and a hearing of claims. I think the desire of the tribes is that these things just pack up their stuff and go away. Mm-hmm. Would that be an accurate way of describing it?
For Lummi?
For Lummi, I know you don't speak for, you know, you're not an official person, but in terms of the farming of Atlantic salmon in our waters, what's the tribal position on that?
Oh, no. Yes, that's what's been coming out of the chairman's office and in my conversations with the council, is that, you know, no, we don't want to go down the road and, you know, much like Cherry Point, we don't want to wait until there's an oil spill to say no. Mm. You know, we're discovering this whole business, you know, these corporate interests and how they came through this process that was really kind of just, you know, shepherded through with really not probably anybody in this room even knowing about it. And it happened and a disaster occurred and we're saying, nope, we got to step back. We've got to go back and do this right.
One of the things that I had heard, and because, as you say, you're the fisherman, I've heard some reports that some of these Atlantic salmon are deformed.
They're pretty odd looking. Yeah, Steve Solomon was sharing with us some of those fish that look like they've been deformed. Yeah, their tails are a lot smaller, and their jaws are overlapping, you know. It's quite weird.
Yikes, not natural. Well, and I don't know why that. I'm not a scientist or a fisherman. My instinct is to blame farmed fishing and the fact that fish are forced into giant pens where they don't have room to move, and they're eating each other's excrement and
full of drugs.
Tell us about the drugs.
Well, the promise of aquaculture, the idea was we can take this species that grows rapidly, we can, you know, build them up really quickly, and we can feed the world healthy, pure salmon. And it has not worked, because what you wind up with when you put a lot of fish into one place in the ocean is you get a lot of parasites like sea louse, which will kill them and things like that. And you create a extra ecosystem kind of around them that eats their waste, that eats them themselves. And so you have to give the fish drugs to keep them alive. And so what we've wound up with are these fish on antibiotics and other chemicals. And there's a very terrifying article from The Guardian from not that long ago about the arms race that these producers are in now, trying to stay one step ahead of the parasites. And at this point, a lot of that is not regulated very well at all anywhere where this is done, in, you know, the United States, in Scotland, in Norway, and the effects of those chemicals on the fish themselves and the surrounding ecosystem is not known, and it's really tremendously dangerous. And at the same time, in order to feed all of these salmon, we're feeding them wild-caught fish. So we are, in a non-sustainable way, taking wild fish out of the ocean to give them to these penned fish, and it's just bad. It's all bad. Don't buy farm fish.
Well, it's interesting how, and maybe not that interesting, how what you're describing is exactly like factory farming on land. It's the same injections, it's the same crowding animals together, and it's the same waste, whether it's in land or water. And it makes me think again of how Lummi issues are, when Lummi resources are always impacted by large factory farming, it seems.
That's the history. when you look at the baseline at treaty signing to today and all those things that occurred to the salmon and our lifeway and the impacts of today's, you know, it's fish farms, and before it was fish traps, before it was the non-recognition of our treaty rights, and on, you know, we have a violation of what I guess what it's called in the predominant world, public trust, you know, and for us that's a sacred trust. It's been violated, you know, through time, you know, all these different things. This occurrence today, though, is different, in that we have an opportunity to unite, you know, those people that joined us the Cherry Point fight, you know, and then even more people. Maybe the we need to call some of these conservancy groups together that are in favor of wild salmon too, so we can figure this out. You know, it's going to benefit everybody if we do.
Well, I am hopeful that we are able to band together, and I have seen that it seems like more and more, as you say, predominant or mainstream or non-native culture is waking up to some of these issues. But at the same time, I think on this show we've talked about the Hearst water well issue until I can't talk about it anymore without falling over. And that water well issue is about impacting your water and Lummi water. But there's also this whole other aspect that we don't talk about how your water can get polluted by companies that are already existing. And that's what I think when I mentioned before, Rosalinda Guillen's longer interview, which will be on our website in the next couple of days, where she was drawing a comparison between Sarbanon Farms and between what's happening there and Cook and how all of this large agriculture impacts your existence.
Yeah, that and you know, it's interesting that you make that connection because, you know, the fantastic thing about tribes and Lummi is the leader among them is that when they're fighting for water in the rivers, they're not only fighting for themselves, they're fighting for fish too, because the fish don't speak, you know, they don't have lawyers that appear in court or something like that and say, you know, there's not enough water in the river for us. Somebody's got to fight for them. Somebody has to, as Daryl has said, be the steward of that resource for seven generations.
Well, to be fair, when the Lummi Nation and other nations are fighting for the rivers and the water and the land, they're fighting for the fish, but they're also fighting for all humans and the way of life and the well-being of all humans.
It kind of ends up being that way because I think we're all up against it. You know, we all see, I guess it's commonly referred to as quality of life, but there's this thing that we think about in terms of know, this holistic care for the environment. You can't just take care of, you know, try to take care of water. You take care of the forests. You take care of the salmon. We're all connected, you know, and begin to think that way, you know, that it's not just the headwaters, but it's also the estuaries. It's also the ocean, the sea, you know, that's all connected. We can't separate that. It's inseparable. It's a if we start thinking that way and working together that way, which is actually just having these conversations and trying to change the politics around this, it's so important.
Well, you mentioned earlier how this has been happening and how the Lummi way of life and Lummi rights to land and so many things have been impacted, and you mentioned treaties. So I want to bring up Children of the Setting Sun, because that's a way that you, Daryl, have been really educating people outside of Lummi about some of the history. And for people who have never heard that phrase before, what is Children of the Setting Sun?
Children of the Setting Sun Productions is, it's a 501c3.
Congratulations.
And all that. But really, it's just carrying on in following the instructions of my great-grandfather, who gathered his grandchildren, which was my father and his first cousins, when he was getting ready to move into the other world, he gave some instructions to them. He said, "Keep my fires burning." And so we're doing that. We're following those instructions. We're creating, I guess they call it content. You know, we create and we share it, and we hope to have education. You know, and that's really when we say that, we mean amongst all people, amongst people that carry these certain gifts, and the people that receive the gifts. There's an exchange, and that's really important to us that we end up in that place when we do this work.
Now, one of the productions, one of the creative fires that you're kindling right now is you're doing a film production.
Right.
Is that correct? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. In 2010, as a council member, back on the council, and I was the treasurer. And at the tribal office, the treasurer, you're kind of shuffling papers and making sure things are doing well. But sockeye season opened, and boom, the whole place was empty. Where'd everybody go? They went fishing. In 2010, there was an epic run of sockeye that came through the homelands of the Coast Salish people, and people caught a lot of fish, and it was great joy, great vibe, great happy feeling in our community. It elevated the community. So I felt that. And then sockeye are on a 4-year cycle, so in 2014 they were anticipated to come back, and they did, but they went the northerly route. They came through the inside strait, Johnstone Strait, and up the Fraser River and bypassed our fishing grounds. So there was a big downer in our community. It went, the vibe was pretty low, and I said, well, what is that? And so I started walking towards that, and I formulated in my head a script to tell that story. The story, the life cycle of the sockeye, and from the headwaters, from birth to the 3,000-mile journey to its return to give birth and then to perish. So that was my intent. And then connect our lifeway, the Coast Salish lifeway, to that and understand the stories and the legends of what the sockeye means to our people. In the play, What About Those Promises, I ran across a script, and Joe Hilaire wrote it. He was my granduncle. In it, he said, the sockeye are our most sacred ancestor. I said, well, what is that? You know, and that's what I wanted to bring to life. So you have this life cycle of a sockeye intersecting with the life cycle of our people. I wanted to show that intersection. Then the third part is I look up to and respect one of my friends, Larry Kinley, who's been fishing his entire life. And he's in his early 70s now, and he's been fishing for over 65 years. And I thought that would be the next intersection, to tell it through his eyes and what he's passing on to his children and his grandchildren for, you know, those things that need to be carried on in our lifeway.
Right, and fish know no borders, and you've got family members on both sides of the borders, and you, if I understand correctly, and it's part of your documentary, are interviewing people of the northern tribe, northern tribes too, and get their story as well.
Right, I went up to Shuswap, where the Shuswap Lake, where Adams River, and where the sockeye returned to spawn. I went up there last week and captured their first salmon ceremony, and they have that when the first sockeye comes back to their reserve. And then, of course, down the river to Stolo Nation and Musqueam at the mouth of the river, and then the Lummi people and Swinomish and all the villages. Yeah, we think of them as reservations, and the old way we think of them as families and villages.
Mm. Dave and I had a chance to see What About Those Promises, and it was really one of the most impactful plays I had ever seen, and explains so much that when people just try to read history, it kind of slides over their heads sometimes. I know it had a few different runs in Bellingham. Is there a chance that people will get to see it again in the future?
Yes and no. It's so hard to put it together. I like to work.
You heard
on
it here first.
Yeah, I like to work on the production side, and I'd love to do that. I love doing that. But on a promotion side, no, because it's too much work. You got to get a stage and lights and all that. And it really is. I need a person to work with on that side of things, and then I think things would become better.
One of your productions was filmed, wasn't it?
The first one they did majority of that one. When it was at Bellingham High School, I think they left out a few songs that we were asked not to share.
And Daryl, you have a book coming out?
Yes, Jacental. We have a contract with UW Press to publish a compilation of stories as told by Coast Salish elders and spiritual leaders with pictures. So we're busy doing that. We've got 20 interviews to do. We've got 13 done. So we've got 7 more to go. And I'll be on the road for the next few months to do that.
And if people wanted to find out more about any of these projects, how would they find out about Children in the Setting Sun or get on your newsletter?
Yes, SettingSunProductions.org is our website. And then Children of the Setting Sun Productions on Facebook.
Wow.
Two best places.
I encourage everybody to look at that. And thank you so much for giving us so much background and depth about the salmon story. We are going to take just a couple of minutes to talk with or play an interview with Satpal Sidhu coming up on Monday, Labor Day, September 4th at 10 a.m. across from Bellingham City Hall. Will be the groundbreaking on the Arch of Healing and Reconciliation. And Satpal tells us a little bit more about that.
2007 was the 100th year anniversary of the Bellingham riots. And we did a event at that time. And whereas the mayor at that time was Tim Douglas, as well as Pete Crimmon, the county executive. So we approached them in 2006, and they said, yes, we are not really aware of the details. So we went through 6 months of research and sharing the information, and they were totally appalled that this thing had happened.
Tell us about the riots.
Back in 1904 to 1906, Bellingham had the largest lumber mills in the world. And so the Sikhs who could come to Canada, because being the Dominion citizens of under the British flag, they didn't need much papers and they can come. And then Bellingham was so close and there was work. Reception was great because the mill managers were looking for hardworking people. And there they were. And so they were about 350, and they started working. And the complaints were the same, which we hear 110 years later. All these people come, and they're not Christians, and they're going to, take away our jobs, and there are thousands and thousands of them going to come behind them, and they work on a weekend. They work on overtime. So it was brewing for a year or so, and some of the officials in the law enforcement as well as on the political side were complicit with this kind of thing, and they encouraged all this inciting. On September 4, 1907, around 9 o'clock, there was a big crowd of, they say, about 500 people. They started going on the lettered streets where the most people lived because the lumber mills were on the waterfront, except the Bloedel Donovan, which was totally away from there. And that's why it didn't affect that mill that night. But they pulled everybody out from their homes. And they harassed them, they pushed them around, and they actually went to the mills and pulled people off the work. And the mill people, managers, everybody, nobody stopped them. And then, after 2-3 hours of this kind of rioting, the police came in and they said, well, let's bring them all into the jail. And they put them in jail. The old city hall.
This
was,
is the Sikh workers. Who
they
have
were
done,
all Sikh workers.
Have done nothing wrong at this point.
No, they haven't done anything wrong. They are totally, law-abiding, hard-working people. And the only thing was they wanted to scare them to get them out of the town. And they did. And that's what happened next morning. They told them that, look, you know, you are lucky that, you know, nobody got killed last night, but you got 24 hours to leave town. Otherwise, we don't know what will happen. And, you know, these people were totally scared. They had no other relatives, no other people to listen to when the law enforcement is saying, well, we can't help you. So what do you do? So they decided to leave town. And half of them went to Vancouver, B.C., and the other half went to California because that's where the other Sikh communities were there, or people knew somebody either from their own town or some relative, and they felt safe that that's what they did. After 1907, 75 years, no Sikh came and lived in Whatcom County or Bellingham, maybe one or two. On the other side of the border, just like 1 mile from the border, like Abbotsford, like Langley, like Surrey, 250,000 Sikhs living there since like 100 years or more. But the event just shook everybody. And of course, the reputation of Bellingham was such that they don't welcome colored people. So then people like me, totally naive, new generation, not knowing anything, ended up in Bellingham. And so that's how I came here in 1986, and there were only 10 families in whole county. And just imagine that in a short period of 20 years, half of the total berry production, blueberry and raspberry production in Whatcom County is done by Sikh farmers. They're hard worker people.
So let's get to talking about this monument.
So September 4, 2007, on the 100th year anniversary, we had an event at the Rotunda in the county courthouse. And we were given a proclamation by the county and the city declaring September 4 as Day of Healing and Reconciliation. And we also, as a community, didn't want to take it into the spirit of revenge or the spirit of apology because things happen in life. What we wanted to do, one is the reminder to everybody that everybody should know that this happened, this is past, this is our past history. The second thing is we wanted to build from there for future of our kids. They are Americans like anybody else. So we wanted to extend our hand and to ourselves that we should be vigilant and we should build love and friendship. So that event happened, and we promised at that time that the community, even being very small, but we would like to build some memorial in the name of these Sikh residents. So the community got together in 2006. We formed a committee. So then a suggestion came that why don't we work with Chinese community and Japanese community because they went through the same thing. They may be a smaller communities here. So we contacted people from Chinese community and Japanese community because Chinese were expelled in 1885 from Bellingham, and they were allowed to come back 10, 15 years later. But they had gone through a lot as well, and not only in Bellingham and Japanese, we all know, which is so recent that 1942, even American-born citizens or American naturalized citizens, for no crime happening, no misdeed done, were incarcerated. So we approached them. They welcomed this idea too. So that's how it became a monument, not only for the Sikhs of 1907, but all immigrants. If you go to our website and see that, we have said this is a monument to all the immigrants, not only the people who went through that ringer in those days, but people who are even recent.
So what's going to happen on Monday?
So on Monday, we are doing a groundbreaking ceremony. We went through about 8 or 9 months of a development process. The concept was not just put a plaque or just a piece of stone, but build an arch. This is the most unique monument in whole United States, and it is made up of red granite, solid granite.
And what's going to happen on Monday?
So this is the groundbreaking ceremony. We believe that it will take a few months to finish that work, and then we have chosen April 21st, 2018 as the day that we will unveil it. April 21st is a Saturday that kind of coincides with the big Sikh holiday, Baisakhi. And a week before that, we want to unveil that.
Are people invited to come to the groundbreaking?
Yes, a lot of people are coming. At least I know of the Sikh community up in Vancouver, as well as in California. We have a doctor, and he's doing work on pioneer immigrants from India in early 1900s. He's coming as a keynote speaker. We have a few people coming from Vancouver who will be speaking, as well as we'll have people from Chinese community, people from Unitarian Church, people from other churches.
So it's not just a groundbreaking. It's actually a whole ceremony on Monday.
Yes, it's a whole ceremony on Monday, 10 o'clock to noon. We have small refreshments available for people. And that's courtesy of the Linden Sikh Temple. And we welcome people to converse and share and ask questions. It is at the corner of Lottie and North Commercial, on that corner of that Lee Park, which is behind the Bellingham Library, Central Library, in front of the City Hall. We are so pleased that the City Council unanimously approved it. So far, we have been welcomed by anybody, everybody I have talked to, so which is a great thing.
Again, that groundbreaking will be Labor Day, Monday morning at 10 a.m. across from City Hall. That was Sat Paul Sidhu we were speaking with. We're here at Cascadia News Now, just wrapping up with Daryl Holera. If people want to support the effort to fight the salmon emergency, what can we do, Daryl?
Well, I think public education. Push for public forums. Maybe this radio station, maybe community leaders can pull us together, and we can have just a full conversation about fish farms. You know, where do they end up? Who are the end consumers? Maybe talk to some of our people in the restaurant business, people in the grocery business, people in the fish handling business, fishermen. You know, people from the from that industry themselves, and really. And get to the root of these kinds of businesses.
Thank you so much. And thank you for taking time while this is all happening, Gerald Hilaire. And I completely agree with you. Let's move forward. Thank you for being on, and hopefully you'll come back and we will have more conversations about this. It's this Cascadia News Now. That was Gerald Hilaire. And I'm Stephanie Contouris. Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham were our co-hosts. Devlin Sweeney is our fantastic engineer. Thank you, Devlin. And you are listening to Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming Van Zandt and KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham.